Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Psychology of Games podcast, where we discuss how psychology and video games interact to shape our behavior, our beliefs, and our purchasing decisions. My name is Jamie Madigan, a psychology PhD and a lifelong gamer. I write and podcast about this stuff at psychologyofgames.com, and I'll be your host. This is the episode about toxic behavior in online games. Before we get started, I wanted to take just a few seconds to point out that I've started a Patreon campaign. Patreon.com is an easy and safe way for listeners and readers to support this podcast and the website. You can donate as little as a dollar a month, and it'll help, though you can also certainly donate more than that, and you'll get some cool benefits as well. So go to patreon.com/POG, that's for Psychology of Games, to check it out. Or you can also always go to psychologyofgames.com and look for the Patreon links there. Okay, we're done. So, I think we can all agree that the internet is a pretty cool place. You can do all kinds of cool stuff. You can shop, you can research, find information, keep track of friends, talk with strangers, do all kinds of great things. But at the same time, it's also pretty awful sometimes. Most gamers have experienced toxic behavior online. You know, whenever you get in to a game and you experience just this onslaught of insults and misogyny and, you know, homophobic behavior and racism and all these other kind of nasty things that people seem to do in online games, and either through chat or through voice chat. It's kind of weird because this probably doesn't happen as much in real life, at least for you. I know it doesn't for me. So when somebody at work takes too long to respond to my email, I don't march over to their office and call them a fucker or a fool or some sort of. This sort of thing seems to be, at least anecdotally, worse, also in certain multiplayer games. I know I've encountered it in first-person shooters. One of my sort of most memorable experiences with toxic behavior actually comes from Team Fortress 2. So one night I was playing the Man vs. Machine mode in that game, which is sort of a cooperative mode where a group, small group of players fights against waves of enemy robots. It's sort of a horde mode. And ideally, in this mode, each one of the players plays as different class because each one of those classes has roles. And I was playing as the Scout.
Boink!
In Man vs. Machine mode, the most important job for the Scout, by far, is to collect the money that dead robots drop. The more money you collect, the more your teammates and you have to spend on upgrades between waves as a Scout. If you fail at that, you really fail at everything.
I'm dying here!
And I was failing at that. And there was another player on the server who, through voice chat, was constantly yelling at me and calling me a lousy Scout and lots of other things I can't really repeat here. And just constant all over, yelling at me, saying all kinds of awful things about my mother.
Well, off to visit your mother.
And at the end of a round, this person actually initiated a vote on the server to kick me. So this is one thing you can do in TF2. You can actually initiate a vote, and the other players can vote on whether or not they want to kick another person off the server. And this guy wanted to kick me for being a poor player. So I just kind of sat back, and it was really was kind of stressed out a little bit, and I was disappointed and annoyed with myself and annoyed with this person, so I was just about to log off. But then I noticed that the other players on the server, they were voting to not kick me off. And in a few seconds, the vote failed. And then a few seconds after that, somebody, at least, else on the team initiated a vote to kick the person who had been yelling at me. And then it unanimously passed, and that person was kicked off of the server, and it was a very satisfying moment.
Yeah.
So not all, I think, is lost, and not all is hopeless. In certain contexts, in certain situations, you can have a group of people who know how to behave, and that behavior can be infectious. This is also true not only in first-person shooters, but perhaps even more infamously so in the MOBA genre, the multiplayer online battle arena. So your League of Legends, your Dota 2s. So these games are often sort of infamous for being toxic and having tough communities to get into and being very unforgiving when new players or bad players make mistakes or just trying to learn the ropes. So the psychologist in me, of course, wonders why this is so. Why do people act so differently online often than they would presumably act in the real world? There can't be this many awful, awful people out there in the real world. One of the things that's usually blamed for this type of behavior is anonymity. When nobody knows who you are on the internet, you're free to do all kinds of awful things. But actually, a lot of the research has shown that anonymity in and of itself isn't sufficient and isn't a full explanation for what's happening. One of the bodies of research that I've followed a lot and read up on a lot talks about de-individuation, which is where a person becomes part of a crowd. They begin to feel like part of a crowd and they start to pay less attention to what they are doing and they start to pay less attention to what the consequences of their actions may be. So it's this sort of thing of you can't see me, or if you do, you're not going to pick me out from the crowd. And then also this concept of I can't see me, or I stop paying attention to my own actions or the reasons for them because there's no consequences and I can actually shift blame for my behavior around. Both of these things tend to happen in online games where we're anonymous and separated from consequences and we are sort of looking for others to define what is acceptable behavior. So in this week's podcast, I'm going to talk to an expert on this topic of toxic behavior and how to use psychology to combat toxic behavior. Jeffrey Lin leads the player behavior team at Riot Games, and Riot is famous for the League of Legends MOBA game. You've probably heard of it. They have several tens of millions of players at any given point in time, sometimes more. It's a type of game where they have to rent out entire stadiums, football stadiums, and other massive venues in order to host annual tournaments across the globe. Incredibly popular game. Also sort of has a reputation for toxic behavior, but Jeffrey Lin and his group are actively trying to combat that. They're a cross-disciplinary team that uses psychology to attack the problem of toxic behavior by applying lessons from social psychology and player motivation, learning theory, decision-making, and even artificial intelligence. What Jeffrey and I are going to talk about is a lot of that. In a lot of ways, Lin and the other people in the player behavior team are textbook examples of how to use psychology and apply it to video games, almost because they literally take the textbook and then cram it into the design documents for the games and for the player management systems around the games. So join me now for a discussion with Jeffrey Lin of Riot's player behavior team on toxic behavior in online games. All right. So as I mentioned before, my guest this week on the podcast is Jeffrey Lin of Riot Games. And again, Jeffrey is probably one of the people whose work you may be familiar with if you've read a lot of my articles on the website. He's certainly somebody whose career I've been following since I started doing this whole thing. So, Jeffrey, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Super excited.
Yeah, as I mentioned, I've been following a lot of the stuff that you guys have been doing. So, you know, for the people listening at home, can you give me an idea of who you are and what you're doing here?
Yeah, so a while back, I used to be in the sciences, actually, as a neuroscientist. But the games company, Riot Games, they were kind of dealing with this issue with online multiplayer games where, you know, spanning back 15 years ago, they found that a lot of online multiplayer games had a lot of kind of online harassment and toxicity. And they really wondered if there's anything that we could do to kind of tackle that problem. So I was brought on board about 3 years ago now to lead a team of a cross-discipline scientists, game designers, engineers, to see what we could do in this space.
And specifically, we're talking about League of Legends, right?
That's right. Specifically in League of Legends.
So League of Legends, it's a somewhat popular game. I think you guys have a few fans out there. One of the MOBA, the multiplayer online battle arena. So tell me a little bit about what it is that you guys do specifically. And I guess tell me about the player behavior team. You're not a one-man show. You got a whole group of people there, right?
That's right. And so this is a really interesting team in the game space. So as you mentioned, it's an online multiplayer battle arena or MOBA, and it's usually played 5v5. So there's a lot of online social interactions at every point of the game. And it's a really hardcore competitive game. So it gets heated sometimes. And toxicity does emerge sometimes because of the style of game that it is. And so what we did with the player behavior team was they brought me on to build a feature team. So if we had game designers, if we had researchers and scientists and engineers, and they could do anything they wanted to the actual game design of the game, could we create games that were more fun but also had less toxicity online? And that was kind of the thesis that started this whole thing.
So what do you mean by toxicity?
Well, so when it gets really heated in online games, one of the common things is like verbal abuse starts to spike really high. You'll see incidences of homophobic slurs or racial slurs. You'll see a lot of those kinds of behaviors emerge. And the common hypothesis, which you've talked about often, is it because players are anonymous online?
Right.
And that's the most popular hypothesis in the last, you know, decade or two. But what we found in our initial research and exploration into League of Legends is that it's not just about being anonymous. We're also finding that just as important is the lack of consequences online.
Yeah. So how big a problem is toxic behavior in games? Is it every time I hear one of those things, in the past, I've not been quite sure, like, well, is this just being drummed up because it's an interesting news story? You know, is it the familiarity bias at work where I'm thinking something is more widespread just because it's so sort of dramatic and easy to recall from memory? You know, how big a behavior is toxic behavior in games in general and in League of Legends in specific?
Well, one way to look at it was, you know, 3-4 years ago, when I was looking into games for the first time, a lot of online multiplayer games, player behavior was the number two reason that players quit playing a game.
Okay.
Really impactful on why players continued or quit the game entirely. Another thing that we recently saw, which was quite interesting, was exposure to this kind of toxicity really increases the churn rates of players in these types of games as well. And some games were showing, you know, up to 40, 50, 60% of their games had examples of these kinds of behaviors. So it really was quite a pervasive issue 4 or 5 years ago.
So you actually got data to show that when people churn, they tend to have more exposure to this sort of toxic behavior.
That's right.
Okay. Do you think it's something that's particular or more widespread in the MOBA genre?
The data suggests that the MOBA genre probably is a little bit more toxic or has higher harassment than other game genres. But I think it boils down to a couple key elements. So it's the only genre, for example, where game lengths are a little bit on the longer side. You got 30 minutes, 45 minutes. It's also one of the game genres where you are entirely dependent on your teammates to actually succeed at the game, right? So when you look at a first-person shooter game, if you have a bad player on your team, you can generally still do well as a team. If you don't really like that player on your team, you can just drop out, drop into another server, another game. You can't really do that in a MOBA. You're kind of stuck with those teammates for the full 30 to 45 minutes. And so every interaction just means that much more.
So it seems like you got a few things there. You have, you know, matches that require a lot of time and sort of investment of maybe limited time. You've got small teams where you can't necessarily rely on other people to pick up the slack. And then you've got sort of this high interdependence amongst team members where, again, you can't let somebody else pick up the slack because every position, I'm assuming, is important, huh?
Exactly. Every position is important, just like a basketball game. You really can't have one weakness on one of those five positions.
So, you know, speaking of basketball games, if you were to go down and get a pickup game down at the gym or, you know, at some neighborhood court, you're probably not likely to see the types of toxic behavior that we're talking about here.
That's right.
But when you play a 5-on-5 game, a League of Legends or other games, and maybe not as much of that behavior in a basketball game where you're face-to-face with people, but you do get more of it online. And you mentioned the anonymity piece. Can you say a little bit more about that? Like, why does anonymity matter?
Yeah, it's really interesting because you're exactly right. When you go on a basketball court, you don't really see this kind of toxicity or harassment. Because you have a lot more social cues, right? You can often see when something you say is considered out of line. You can see if you're causing some issues or you're causing kind of harm or pain in somebody else in person. You're missing a lot of those social cues online. So a lot of players, when they face one of our kind of behavioral systems and they get a penalty, they'll often look at the actual evidence that they received on why they were being punished, and they'll say, well, I was just kind of kidding around, right? I didn't expect that person to take offense to what I just said. But now that I know, I'll try not to use those kinds of things in the future. So that person in real life would probably have enough social cues to realize that, hey, what he or she is doing is kind of out of line with what society expects. And online, because we're missing so many social cues, and because it's more anonymous than real life, I think that's why we see some of these behaviors do emerge.
So as you probably know, I kind of have a theory about all this. And I believe that you read one of the advanced chapters of my book that I sent over to you, where I talked about a lot of the stuff that you're doing there and the stuff that we're talking about on this podcast. And I talked about it in the context of not just anonymity, but sort of this concept of, in psychology, of de-individuation, you know, where the idea is that when you are made to feel like a part of a crowd, and there's sort of two things that happen, you know, one is that you feel that other people aren't paying attention to what you're doing, or even if they are, your identity isn't at risk because you're not using, you know, your real name, your identity is cloaked, or if you are using an online identity, it's not one that's particularly important to you. It's sort of disposable. And then the other thing that happens is that you sort of lose track of your own behavior and sort of this, I can't see me effect. And, you know, where we wear masks and, you know, the things that we do kind of get drowned out in the crowd. Or we can sort of shift the blame to a scapegoat within the group and say that person's much worse, or this is acceptable because the game, you know, developers have the system, you know, they have a chat system. So of course I can, you know, say whatever I want in it, or, you know, any number of different things that sort of allow you to shift blame and take focus away from your own behaviors.
Okay.
The key then becomes like, how do you, well, when people are de-individuated, they tend to look to the group for like clues as to how to behave. They look for information about what the social norms are in that group and their own sort of ideas about what's appropriate to do or say are, you know, displaced by those group norms. So then it becomes a matter of like, how do you sort of shape the environment, shape the social structure, shape the social environment to reinforce the behaviors that you want and punish or disincentivize the ones that you don't. Sorry, I kind of just seem to have taken over the interview talking about that, but it seems that a lot of the work that you're doing, you know, at Riot, the player behavior team, is centered around that idea of shaping the social environment so that you can get the behaviors that you want out of people who are experiencing, you know, maybe a sense of de-individuation or a sense of like becoming part of a crowd. So can you talk to me a little bit about some of the specific experiments that you guys have tried or systems that you've built into the game that get at shaping the social environment?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting. I had flashbacks to a couple of years ago having these exact conversations. And it's interesting because when players are online, the actual crowd that they think they belong to is some kind of ambiguous internet collective. Mm. It's like, what does the internet think is okay or not okay? And they had really deviant expectations and behaviors after years of the internet evolving in a really negative way, because it was anonymous and it lacked complete consequences for any type of action. And so after these conversations, we thought everything that we do in League of Legends cannot be from Riot Games to the players. It cannot be from a authoritative perspective. Riot Games cannot be the arbitrator or the judge of behaviors. We cannot define what is okay or not okay, because we would never be able to kind of influence the internet collective. So the question really was, how do we change social norms online? And so this is why, actually, if you think about this conversation and back to the first experiment we ever did on League of Legends, it was something called the Tribunal. And what the Tribunal basically did was it copied examples of chat logs from players and posted them back online, of course, with some of the names and private information scrubbed and so on and so forth. And other players can look at this information and they can vote and they can decide, is this okay or not okay in League of Legends? And that was key, because when the case was closed and we decided whether to punish this player or do nothing, or in the future reward this player, the key was that player then receives all that information from other players. And we make it very explicit that, hey, your fellow peers have decided that this kind of behavior just isn't okay. And what was really interesting to us when we started that system, it took just about 6 months for social norms to completely change and do 180s. And it really surprised all the scientists on staff, because we thought, wow, we never expected a cultural norm to change that quickly.
Huh.
And so ever since that first experiment, every single feature we've done and experiment that we've done has been from how do we get the players themselves to define what's okay or not okay and change their norms? Because that's the only way we're going to see any long-term changes to this culture.
So you had people who, when asked directly, like, is this cool? Is this acceptable behavior? They would say no. But then when they were playing a game, they might engage in that type of behavior anyway? Or did you see a lot of overlap between the problem players and what they said, when asked about somebody else's poor behavior?
That's a great question, actually. So we saw an evolution over time. So if you take something like at the very, very, very beginning of the experiment, there was a large chunk of players when posed that question, they would often say things like, well, in real life, this is not okay, but online, it's okay. And over time, that population slowly made up their minds and kind of converged on the idea that, hey, homophobia is just not okay. It doesn't matter what the context is. And so over the 6-month period, we saw stuff like anything that had homophobic slurs in them were among the most rejected behaviors in the entire experiment. And the instant they saw anything like that, it was an instant, hey, that is not okay. We have to punish that particular behavior. Hmm. But it did take some time to see that evolution happen because early on, a lot of players were kind of confused about, shouldn't online be different than offline? And should we have the same expectations or not? And that really showed through in the voting.
So the critical piece of that loop that you closed was getting the feedback back to the original person about his or her behavior, right?
That's right. And as soon as they saw that it was other players putting them in that position to kind of reflect, that made all the difference compared to if Riot had simply banned them and said, Riot doesn't think you should be able to do this online.
Right. Well, then you've got the opportunity to – you've got a scapegoat. So, you can blame your behavior on, what Riot says or then point to larger internet culture and say, well, the internet says it's okay, so I'm going to stop paying attention to what I'm doing.
That's right. That's right. One funny anecdote in the early days was some of the players who were persistently negative online or were constantly slinging around sexual slurs and racial slurs. They did a Reddit poll and online forum poll on both our forums and Reddit, basically saying, "Hey, like, is this kind of behavior okay or not?" And they wrote paragraphs and paragraphs about how this is how it's always been on the internet. This is okay on the internet. And it was just pages and pages of other players telling this player that, no, this is not okay. We don't know what you're talking about anymore. And it was really interesting to see that unfold.
Yeah, and I think, at some of the GDC presentations that you've given, you've told the story about the one player who was kind of shocked to find out that using, a certain racial slur, the N-word, was not acceptable and was like genuinely surprised when he was told otherwise.
Right.
Which just seems so shocking that like any sort of normal person in this culture should know that, but I guess you're not born with it and you take different assumptions with you online.
And I think that's a really key point. So there's two interesting things there. One, people often ask me, like, how do you know that young boy was genuine when he was apologizing for such a thing? And I always reflect back. He never asked for his account back. Right. He never asked for any favors. He just accepted responsibility for what he did and he just continued and played on. Right. And the second thing is it really goes to show that we're in a world now where a lot more kids are growing up on the internet and they're learning about social etiquette, about basic kind of fundamental skills like teamwork and cooperation. They're learning these things online versus maybe in more traditional activities. And so the question for us really is, how much impact can we have on players learning the right behaviors online? And is it our responsibility to even intervene in this? And I think it's still an ongoing debate at a studio like Riot Games. How much of this is our responsibility as games makers?
Hmm. So you mentioned that the tribunal was one of the first things that you did. But it centered around this idea of providing players with feedback and helping them understand the norms and what's acceptable. What is that whole approach to, curbing toxic behavior look like today? How has that evolved?
Yeah, so since the original tribunal experiment, one of the flaws was that the speed of the feedback loops were way too slow. So much like a real-life jury system, it takes time to get the evidence, takes time to actually do the voting, do the conversations between the jury or the panel itself, And then it takes time to close the case and deliver the feedback to the players. It, you know, in the early days, it took maybe a week, sometimes weeks even, when a player committed something negative in a game and actually received some consequences for that or feedback for that. And so we took some time to build out a machine learning team. It was a really promising field a year or two ago, and a lot of really interesting advancements were being made using that technology. And so we upgraded the system to basically use machine learning to learn off player reports in the game. And so what happens today is every single time a player reports somebody in the game, we have this machine learning system that learns from it and tries to learn, hey, what about that behavior was offensive? What about what that person said bothered that other person? And it tries to learn and classify these behaviors now on a real-time basis.
So what input is that based on? Like, what is, or what tells it that somebody has been offended or finds something unacceptable?
Yeah, so one of the key assumptions is that every time a player tries to report somebody, so file a complaint against another player in the game for a variety of things, whether it's ribald abuse or spamming, intentional feeding, so on and so forth, our assumption is that every time that happens, it might not be accurate, but something about that experience bothered that person, and we just don't know what yet. And so even if a player files a false report, something drove that player to that extra action, and we need to understand why. Was that player just – does he have a different sensitivity to negative behaviors than other players? Did he have a misunderstanding? And so the machine tries to figure out with every single report action what caused it. And was it positive, was it negative, or was it neutral? And do we need to punish it or reward it in the future?
So what – I guess I'm still not quite understanding what the machine is. Is it a computer program? Is it like some deep blue machine that's sitting in the back of somebody's office? Have you created artificial life? What's going on?
Depending on what field of computer science you're in, some people might call it an artificial intelligence. Other people might call it's just a software app. And what it's doing is it's actually looking for patterns and behaviors. So imagine a really, really simple case would be, let's say I can identify positive players in the game by hand. I'm like, hey, these 100 players, they are the most positive people in League of Legends. And I find another set of players that are super negative. I'm like, these players, they always use racial slurs in games. So the 100 most negative players in games. And what this AI does is it basically looks at those two groups of players and it tries to figure out what is in common between the players that are in the same groups and what is different across those groups. Are there certain phrases and jokes that one group makes that the other does not make? Are there certain play patterns or play styles that one group does but the other group doesn't? So it tries to kind of figure out the characteristics of human behavior by looking at stuff like chat logs, in-game stats, how your champions are played in games, what kinds of champions you might play, how you interact with others when you're communicating in some in a place like champion select, which is the kind of lobby right before the game starts. So it tries to learn and look for patterns in all those different kinds of data.
So do you have any impressive figures on like the number of data points or the amount of data that this thing churns through?
Somebody once tried to ask me to quantify that. And I think we were over the point of like 100 million data sets per day.
Good
per
Lord.
Server. So we're talking trillions of data sets over time. And the system itself has been learning for about 6 months now. So it's hard to even quantify or imagine that number today.
Yeah, because you got like what, 70 million or somewhere in that neighborhood players?
Yep. And every single game, it's not just one data point, right? It's every single line of chat, every kill, every assist, every coordinates of where players are standing in the middle of the field, right? So every game is actually, you know, hundreds of thousands of data points as well.
Man, what a time to be alive.
It's so true.
So what are the consequences of running afoul of the machine? What if it turns its baleful eye upon you? What happens?
So right now in the initial launch of the system, we're focused on the really aggressive behaviors first, which will earn you either a 14-day ban. Some servers have a 30-day ban or it's a permanent ban. So if the system identifies you as consistently using homophobic slurs, racial slurs, sexist slurs, you will immediately get one of these heavier penalties. In the future, what we're working on right now is incorporating the chat restrictions and ranked restrictions into the system itself, and then stuff like low priority queues. So for people who don't know what the chat restrictions are, it's basically if we notice that you are verbally toxic a lot, so you say a lot of toxic things in games, we will actually limit the amount of chat that you can have in games. So you start with 3 lines of chat, and this basically forces players into a constant moral dilemma situation.
So that's three lines of chat for the entire match?
For the beginning of the match, and it increases over time if you behave.
Okay.
Yeah, and it forces players into this moral dilemma of, do I use my chat resources now for communicating with my team to help me win the game, or do I still be a jerk? And it turns out that a lot of these players, they care more about winning than being a jerk. So this feature is super effective at changing how these players use language. And we see about 75% of players, once they go through this experience, they actually improve their language permanently, and they never exhibit these kind of behaviors again.
Wow. Okay. So it just takes one experience along those lines, and they improve their behavior, at least a lot of the time.
And I think that's the interesting data set for many people working in games or in real life on these problems, which is the obvious solution was to simply remove chat, right? Just mute the players. They can never use chat again, and they can continue playing. But there's two big flaws with that. One, if the players don't have an avenue to practice what good behavior looks like, they never have a forum or avenue to practice that. And so what usually happens is the same players will now find different ways to be negative. Either they'll find ways to assist the enemy team, or they'll run around and give kills on purpose to the other team. They're not given a way to practice.
That's called feeding. I know my terminology.
Right.
Sorry, I interrupted your train of thought. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that was it. It's really important, I think, when we think about online reform or kind of changing cultural norms, that we give users and players in these communities a way to practice what good looks like. We can't simply remove access.
Or remove the player entirely, or at least not too readily.
Exactly. I think removing a player is always the last resort, because we're only going to move towards easier and easier access in communities and online games. Removing as the first resort just means you're shifting the problem instead of solving it.
So to kind of summarize, what are the characteristics of effective feedback for player behavior in a game like this?
I think the most important thing that we've learned is that speed is almost everything. If the difference between delivering feedback within the hour that something happens versus the second hour, we're talking double-digit differences in the actual reform rates. But once you get to like a couple days later, a couple days and a couple weeks is not as different. So speed is super important when talking about feedback. But the second thing is also clarity. So one thing we learned was we did an experiment testing different kinds of information that we would give players when they're punished. So one, we would just tell players, hey, this is the kind of behavior that got you punished, whether it was racism or sexism or homophobia, for example. That was decent. It at least allowed players to reflect on the categorical type of behavior that was leading to their punishment. And we saw about 50% of players reform because of that kind of information. But then we experimented with extremely detailed feedback. So exact lines that the players said that warranted the punishment, or in the future, very soon, we're testing the exact games and the game stats that led to an intentional feeding punishment. In the verbal version, we're seeing reform rates now in the 80% range when they have specific evidence. So both speed and clarity, I think, are the critical factors to feedback.
So when you say 80%, you mean there's 80% of the people that receive that kind of feedback see a reduction in the number of reports that they get?
Exactly. So we actually go a step further than that. Which is 80% of the players that are punished and receive that feedback, they don't receive a second punishment again.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's an even stronger effect.
Exactly.
I mean, that just sort of reminds me about basic feedback. You know, in my day job as an industrial organizational psychologist, when you talk about giving people feedback about their job performance, you know, it's always make it specific, make it quick, you know, timely, make it something that they can improve and
examples, right? Not ambiguous.
Yeah. Specific, you know, tell them exactly what they did right or wrong. So yeah, once again, tenets of psychology finding their way into the video games. I love it.
Yep. I love it too. It would be worth if these principles did not apply.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think we'd have much to do. So shaping the social cues and the idea of what's acceptable through feedback sounds like one of the main ways that you're tackling toxic behavior in games. What are some of the other ways? Like, you know, can you tell me about some of the other experiments that you guys have run?
Yeah, so what's interesting is we've been doing a lot of outreach to universities and kind of labs to ask for collaborations on some of this research and work to see, you know, if we leverage the kind of expertise of these world-class scientists, what other ideas could we have in this space? And I think what's really interesting is almost every psychologist we talk to, the first thing they say is, well, why don't you try some positive reinforcement? A lot of research showing that positive reinforcement or giving rewards for good behaviors is much more effective than punishing negative behaviors at changing behaviors. And so what's interesting, we started testing this a little bit, and what we found was quite interesting. So if we do reward positive behaviors, they were most effective only on affecting the neutral players. So players that were kind of like on the line, they would once in a while be negative, and a gentle nudge with a positive reward would often be enough to nudge them towards the positive spectrum. But it had really weird effects on the opposite, on the other two kind of demographics. So on persistently positive players, it really kind of intervened with motivation sometimes. So a positive player would often say things in the open feedback like, well, I'm already positive. Why are you giving me something to do this? Like, I'm positive because I want to be positive, not because you're paying me to do it. And so it really kind of intervened with their motivation and hurt their kind of persistence in being positive long term. For that persistently negative players, what was really interesting was it really depends on the reward. So if you have a persistently negative player who is really interested in competitive League of Legends, then if the reward was something tied to social status or competence or skill or mastery, really impactful on that demographic. And if the reward was not something they were interested in, completely no change in their behaviors. Hmm. So what's interesting is moving from the initial experiments, we're thinking rewards are effective and neutral players are among the largest demographic in online games. So they're useful for that alone. But for the other two demographics, persistently negative and positive players, we have to be very careful how we design the actual rewards.
Yeah, what you were describing with the positive players, you know, people who are normally on good behavior, sort of reminds me of the idea of changing the social contract or the relationship when you start paying somebody to do something that they normally do just because they want to. And when you start introducing a reward and, you know, give them more reward, you know, a piecemeal based on their performance, then a lot of other research has shown that they're actually much less motivated to keep doing that task. And then they start to scale their behavior with the magnitude of the reward, which a lot of times means they do less of the good things or less, you know, they're less motivated.
Exactly.
Yeah, again, that makes sense.
So in the early days of the system, we actually paid players a little bit of in-game currency to participate in the system. So every time you looked at a case and you rated the behaviors as okay or not okay, we gave you 10 in-game currency, 10 IP. And what was really interesting was we worried about how this was affecting motivation of these players. So we did an experiment where we removed the currency reward completely and didn't even replace it with anything else. And what was really interesting was we saw a huge spike in engagement, actually. So more players used the system than before. They rated more cases than before. And actually, the people that were now voting in the system were among the most positive in all of League of Legends. So it was really surprising to everybody internally how removing that extrinsic reward actually did much better on the voting of the system itself and actually encouraged the right players to come and vote instead.
Hmm. So did they have like social capital invested at this point and in the system, do you think?
I'm not sure they did at that point, because our next experiment after this was adding a mechanism for social capital, which was adding a way for players to see how do they contribute to the community itself. And that really blew up the engagement numbers by over 100%, actually. Hmm. So I think that middle ground, that first experiment, I'm not sure there was any social capital. It was just interesting to see that we attracted the right players by removing the rewards.
That is really interesting and sort of counterintuitive, which are always the most interesting, you know, studies.
Exactly.
So any other sort of experiments, you know, let me ask you about one in particular, the Optimus Prime experiments that you've talked about in the past, where you sort of did some very basic nudging of players through the text that you showed them in, like, I guess it was loading screens or some interstitial screens.
Yeah. So, I mean, coming from a psychology background, you learn a lot about priming and how it's quite effective at kind of nudging behaviors a certain way. So our initial hypothesis was, is it even possible to use priming in an online game? And if you're a psychologist, this worries you a lot because you're like, well, everybody's computers are different. Everybody's timing is different. Some people won't see the messages. Some people will. It's actually a really complicated experiment. So it turns out when we ran this experiment, that very, very gentle nudges had huge impacts on behavior in the game. So when we made a call out that, if you are kind of condescending to a player when they make a mistake, they just perform worse. Little nudges like that had a really big impact on player behavior in the game, on number of reports kind of filed against other players in the game. And again, we tailored and designed all the information to kind of leverage the fact that players love to win, right? So a lot of the tips are designed on, if you do these good behaviors, you're more likely to win games. So it's really interesting to see that small little one-line tips can have impacts as large as 15% in terms of reduced complaints in a game.
Wow, 15%. And that may not seem huge, but it's literally just putting some text up on a screen. That's practically no cost.
It's one sentence for a couple seconds before the game begins. Just something like that could get you 15% effects.
Cool. My favorite sort of experiments that you've done that I know about, at least, has to do with the team builder system. So when you go into a match in League of Legends, you get dumped into a matchmaking lobby and you're paired up with four other people to form a five-person team. And then you sort of decide on what champion you're going to play and what role you're going to play and so forth. And that can be hectic, I guess, to say the least. So what have you guys done around that to help shape player behavior?
Yeah. Team Builder was one of probably the largest experiments that we tried in 2014 for League of Legends. And even though it was a new way to play the game, there was something in the range of 100 different things being explored and researched in the making of that particular system. And it was all about interactions and dynamics, basically. So a lot of the research and a lot of the interesting lessons we learned were, if you're going to choose five random people to put into a game, how do we ensure the best possible game experience? And now we're looking at things like, hey, what is your personality like? What kinds of people would you be a good teammate for? So if you're somebody who uses offensive language a lot and you don't mind it at all, maybe we can pair you with other players that have the same mindset.
So you literally have a slur slider.
I wouldn't say it's a slur slider because there's tons of other dimensions too, right? Like, for example, how crazy do I like playing in terms of strategy? Or do I always like playing standard meta, right? Which is like what the standard strategy of today is in League of Legends. Or do I like being creative and trying new experimental strategies? And there's all these different dimensions of how you could slice a player's kind of personality. And we started learning some really interesting things. Like, if you have one core team of friends in a particular group, do not combine them with a second group of friends, because as soon as you do that, there's conflicts between those two groups of friends, and you just have a worse game because of this. There, if I remember correctly, in the double digits, so like 20% more complaints just by doing something like that.
I was just going to say, I'm going to let my confirmation bias run wild here and say that, again, that sort of suggests that when you got a group of people together who feel anonymous and like, they're a de-individualized part of a crowd, having two or three people who know each other and can sort of take the lead on setting examples for what's appropriate behavior in that group. And, the remaining two or three people are going to be much more likely to clue into that. And you can actually use psychological judo to use de-individuation to your benefit.
That was exactly the point. And it was super interesting to see that actually pan out effectively, where if you put a group of friends together and they do define the kind of setting for the particular game, and then you kind of add solo players to that particular team, they are more likely to conform to that good setting that the initial group set. And it was really amazing to see those results. And that was one of the key lessons from Team Builder. One of the other experiments that we were kind of surprised by was the idea of verbal commitment. So in games, usually, when you get into a lobby and you're kind of paired with random strangers getting ready to play a game, there's something called a ready check. And you can hit that button as soon as you enter the lobby saying, I'm ready to play this game. And everybody else has to hit ready before you can start the game. That's normal game design, but we did a small tweak to it, actually. After everybody joined the lobby, that was the time that we then introduced the ready check. And after everybody hits the ready button, there's a captain that we have in the game that now has to start the game. So we added the extra step of everybody's in lobby now before you can actually hit ready check for yourself. And once everybody hits ready, somebody still has to initiate the action to start the game. And it was really interesting because we changed the kind of framework of how a person thinks in that situation. And so some of our surveys showed that before, when a player thinks is, hey, am I ready or not? Do I have the settings that I want, the champion I want to play in this game? Am I okay or not? And they hit the ready button. But when we change the additional step a little bit to everybody's now in the lobby before you can say yes or no, ready or not, and a captain has to start the game afterwards, we change the question that they're asking themselves to, hey, am I okay with what everybody else is doing? And that slight little twist in the framework showed a lot of positive behavior benefits in the game afterwards.
So again, it's not just about me. It's more like, am I happy and do I understand what the group is expecting of each other?
Exactly. And it's just changing that little anchor to be about kind of your peers and the team collective, not just about you personally.
And how'd that work out?
It was great. So we actually saw a lot less leavers and AFKs in that particular experiment. So players were less likely to abandon the game in the middle of a match. And we argue it's because they're more committed to what their team set out to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, that lines up with the whole idea of, you know, verbal commitments and publicly stated goals to say like, okay, I'm going to play top with, you know, this champion and this gear and I'm going to take on this role, and then you're more likely to actually do it.
Exactly. That was exactly what we saw. It was really interesting to see a simple ready check could actually produce that kind of verbal commitment.
Anything else? Where do things stand today? What have you guys got cooking, or what are you getting ready to roll out, or what have you recently done?
I think one of the key things is we haven't done a very good job on the positive reinforcement side. So we have worked longer on the punishment systems. And we're really focused in the rest of this year, actually, on how do we actually do the same kind of feedback for positive behaviors. And so what we're working on right now is a new version of the tribunal where players can actually vote on the best behaviors. So the system will randomly pull behaviors that it thinks are either neutral or positive, and players can now log in and they can vote on, you know, how positive do they think that behavior was. And if the players believe that that behavior that the system pulled was a positive example of behavior, we're going to immediately send that player an in-game notification saying, hey, your peers have rated you among the most positive players in the game, and here's a small prize for you for being so awesome. So we're really hoping that if we do the exact same things we've done with feedback on the negative side, that we're going to see big gains over the next year on the positive spectrum as well.
Okay. So how do you think all of this sort of can spill over into not only other games of any type, of any genre, but also to life outside of games?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting this year was a lot of other companies and universities have started noticing a little bit of these kinds of experiments on League of Legends, and they have reached out for help, actually. Whether it's online social media platforms or messaging applications or even like different apps for universities on collaboration and teamwork and how grad students work together. And we've been super interested in trying to share our best practices and our lessons. And we've kind of opened our doors a little bit and are completely open to sharing everything we have with these institutions to try to do what we can to help. So I think moving forward, whether, you know, a lot of these principles, they can apply almost anywhere, whether it's helping our education, whether it's helping us build better teams in the future in schools or businesses, whether it's as simple as, you know, how do we change norms in online social media today? And so it's going to be really interesting the next kind of 12 to 16 to 18 months.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, do you have any feeling or even any data for if somebody decides, I'm going to take a break from League of Legends and go play some Call of Duty or browse Reddit, of how League players' behaviors differ from non-League players? Or is that sort of a dream study?
I would love to do that kind of study. And one of our hopeful dreams is that one day in the future, League players are the best teammates, right? The best teammate gamers in the world. And I would love to try that study one day just to see, hey, are these kind of behaviors carrying over into other games or maybe even to real life? You know, are we actually shaping, you know, the next generation of gamers to have different cultural norms and to think differently about the internet? But we have a ways to go to research that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, there's your mission statement. You can have that one for free. Print it off, put it up on a wall.
I'll show you next time you're here.
There you go. I guess one of the last questions I have about the research that you all have done is, you know, looking back, and it's been what, like three, would you say like 3 years and change or since you started
doing
this?
We're coming up to 3 years.
3 years. Okay. So looking back on 3 years, how's your attitude towards how best to tackle this stuff change? Have you made any big shifts in priorities or have you tossed out any assumptions that you had at first but found out weren't doing you any good? You know, how does the player behavior team of today differ?
Yeah, I think one of the key things that we learned early on was that the old solutions that most game studios and kind of social media companies were trying were really ineffective because we had incomplete toolkits. So every company in the old days simply banned players, so completely removed them from the ecosystem. But as we move forward into the digital age, it's easier and easier to kind of make new accounts, rejoin the ecosystem. We really need to focus on changing the norms. So I think that was one of the key lessons that we learned very early on and has kind of persisted throughout. Another key lesson that we learned was that really, we need the help of other studios and companies to truly tackle this problem. You know, League of Legends players, they play everything. They play MMOs, they play first-person shooters, they play card games. They literally play every single genre you can think of. And so we really need every other kind of game studio to start thinking about this space and realize that this is an important space that can have really meaningful impact to their long-term engagement of their games as well, because we don't think we can actually solve this problem alone anymore, which is why this year's focus on, you know, reaching out to other game studios and universities for collaboration.
Yeah, I love it. That's one of the characteristics, the defining characteristics of science is, you know, collaboration and sharing. So you're definitely on the right track.
I totally agree. And I think moving forward, it'll be really exciting to see, you know, something like a player behavior team kind of evolve and emerge on, you know, almost every company that deals with online interactions, because this really is, I think, a huge space in the future for us.
Yeah. And it seems like if you could point to some data to say, you know, we did this and it resulted in this, you know, increase in whatever metric is important, retention rate or in-game purchases or players, you know, recommending the game to a friend. And, you know, if you can point to relationships between what you're doing and those business metrics that matter, then suddenly a lot of companies will be saying like, well, how do I set up my own team? Because it seems like in the past it's been, well, we got them to buy the game, they're playing, our job is done, and we can ban them if we have to.
Right. I mean, one of the easiest stats that we've been actually sharing is, hey, if a player in your game is exposed to toxicity, they are 320% more likely to never play your game again. And now everybody's like, whoa, whoa, what? What did you say? And they're like, yeah, almost no other single factor has that kind of impact.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe it. Okay. So let's kind of start winding down. I know, you know, we've been on here for a while now, and I don't want to keep it too long, though it seems like we could keep talking about this forever. I sort of have the great shame of admitting that MOBAs, like, you know, like League of Legends, is one of my gaming blind spots. I've never really gotten into it. I played just about everything else, but have always kind of steered away, A, because it seems like such a massive time commitment to really, you know, learn the game and get to the point where I'm really experiencing it. And B, this, I guess, everything we've been talking about for the last hour, you know, sort of the reputation they have. But say I'm determined to check out League and I want to try it out. So, you know, Jeffrey Lin, advise me. What should I do?
Actually, what's really funny is going even back to the original days of MOBAs, the best advice I can give is bring a friend, right? If you have somebody beside you and you're both learning the game at the same time, that is one of the best gaming experiences that I've ever even experienced in games. So I remember back in the early 10 years ago, even playing the original Dota, it was me and my brother. And we both learned everything. We both experienced a bunch of all the champions and their skills. We were surprised every day at what this champion actually did to us. Really playing a MOBA with a friend is probably the peak of gaming experiences today.
Okay. Now that's got me thinking. I have, you know, a daughter who's a gamer, and I could probably, you know, set up a second computer in here and get her going on it. So yeah, there we go. Some father-daughter bonding.
One of the best experiences right now to kind of start off is to play the co-op versus AI mode. So if you and your daughter jump in there and start learning together in that particular mode, it's a pretty good experience today.
Okay, good. I'll take that advice. And when we talk again, maybe I can give you some tips.
Well, 100% looking forward to it.
One other question I always like to toss out. What have you been playing? Anything besides League of Legends? Have you had any chance to do any gaming?
I technically am a game designer, so I'm supposed to be playing almost everything out there. I've been enjoying a lot of different mobile games recently.
Yeah, like what?
So Monument Valley has been a great one for me. I've been checking out a lot of the kind of battle simulators. Stuff like Heroes Charge has been kind of interesting to me because they kind of touch upon a little bit of the strategy. I've played Puzzles and Dragons for a long time, which I am ashamed to admit.
There's no shame.
I really do enjoy puzzle games these days. But other than that, most of my kind of core time is playing League of Legends. And I'm still trying to kind of get my rank up this year. So
yeah,
I've ended every single year platinum or higher in ranked in League of Legends. And I haven't gotten there yet this year.
Now, technically, you could just go into some database, right, and flip a bit. And
if I don't make it by the end of the season, that might be a last resort.
Yeah. So I swinging hard the other direction from your mobile games. I've been playing nothing but triple A's lately. I finished Grand Theft Auto 5 on the Xbox One, and it's a really amazing game. It's just so huge and so detailed. I've played every single Grand Theft Auto game since, you know, the modern ones, that since GTA 3. That this is the first one that I've actually finished the single player campaign and played all the way through it.
The Witcher 3 yet then?
The Witcher 3 is the other game that I just started playing a couple of days ago.
Okay. You have to tell me how it is.
It's great. Yeah. And so, yeah, like double whammy on the huge open world games of going, you know, between those two. But yeah, Witcher 2 is great. I just started playing it, and I actually earlier today, I was playing it for a while, and I got out of the tutorial sort of area that they put you in to sort of teach you about the mechanics and about the structure of the game and the world. You finish that, and you go into, there's like some exposition stuff, and then you go into the next real area in the game, and you open up like your world map, and it's just this like confetti explosion of like quest markers and points of interest. And there's like six of these notice boards that you can go to reveal even more, you know, side quests and things to go check out. And it's huge. And then there's like three or four more areas like that, of that size or bigger, I understand. So, you know, they're saying like this is a 200-hour game. I could see it. I hope I can get through it. Again, just like with Grand Theft Auto, I started playing The Witcher 1 and 2 and then maybe played like 30 hours or so and then just sort of petered out. But this one just looks so amazing. I'm playing it on the PC this time, and it just looks incredible. It's sort of one of those games where you always talk about those moments you have where like, you know, oh, I just like set the controller down and looked at the sunset. And, you know, that sounds like really hokey, but seriously. You know, this is one of those games. I did that. And I'm like taking screenshots and I'm like, I don't know who I'm going to show these to, but I have to, you know, have some evidence of this experience. So yeah, I highly recommend it. It seems like it's going to be a lot of fun. Well, thanks again for taking the time. If, you know, people are curious about either you or the work that, you know, the player behavior team and Riot are doing, where's the best place on the internet to look you up and keep track of you?
Yeah, so the easiest place to reach us right now would be our own forums on League of Legends or on Twitter, actually. So we're pretty active on Twitter, and myself, I am Riot Lite. So it's R-I-O-T-L-Y-T-E.
Great. Well, we'll do that, and I will continue to follow you and see what's going on, and I'll report back on my League of Legends introduction and see how it goes for us.
Thanks for having me today.
All right. Appreciate it very much. Once again, you reached the end of the podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed this one as well. Please, while you're thinking about it, take a second to go subscribe in your service of choice. If you need the iTunes or the RSS feed for the podcast, you can go to psychologyofgames.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can also find links on how to follow me on Twitter and Facebook, if you like. So last episode, I asked all of you to write me in at podcast@psychologyofgames.com with some thoughts on the podcast and what you thought and any suggestions you may have. Many of you did, and I appreciate that. Thank you very much for that. The assignment for this episode of the podcast is for you to go check out that Patreon campaign at patreon.com/POG, or you can go again to psychologyofgames.com to get links for that as well. So once again, I was your host, Jamie Madigan, for this episode, and I will be your host again for the next episode. I'll see you then.